Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Century Insurance versus Moss.
May I please report, Mr. Mark Leifert, who is an argument for petitioner. The court has reserved 5 minutes for the bus.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. We're here on petitioner's point of error number 4 from the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals dealing with an employment issue that arose with Century Insurance and the respondent, Golden Moss. We're here on point number 4, which raises the question as to whether or not the Texas Insurance Code is applicable to the employment dispute between Century Insurance and Mr. Moss when he was not hired by Century Insurance. Very briefly, Mr. Moss sought employment with Century Insurance in the Beaumont area. He went through an employment interviewing process that was very extensive. He did sign an employment agreement which permitted Century to terminate him after he had been with the company 30 days, and he was so terminated before really completing the entire interviewing process. As a result, he filed an action in the Beaumont court alleging that there was negligent misrepresentation, negligence, gross negligence, a violation of the DTPA and the Texas Insurance Code. The case was tried as a bench trial before the judge in Beaumont. The judge rendered actual damages of $275,000, punitive damages of $75,000, and specifically attorney's fees. In finding of fact number 53, the trial court specifically awarded attorney's fees under the Texas Insurance Code, as well as additional damages for fraud. And so what we're here today is the question whether the Texas Insurance Code is a permissible statute to be found in the employment setting where the relationship involved between the parties is that of employer and employee or potential employee. The Texas Insurance Code is very specific in its purpose, and in the declaration section, it specifically says that the purpose of that code is to deal with the regulation of trade practices in the insurance industry. Century's position is that that is a very narrow definition of what that code provision pertains to. It doesn't pertain to all of the nuances that any employer has with its employees. Otherwise, what we are doing, if we buy the respondent's argument, is carving out a special exception for employees who are employed with insurance companies that anytime they have a dispute with their employer, they will be allowed to seek the remedies under the Texas Insurance Code, which allows for treble damages for actual damages.
You refer to it as narrow. It sounds pretty general to me. It's, by its terms, Article 2121 essentially implements or is a companion to the Magnuson, to the McCarran-Ferguson Act.
That's right, Your Honor.
And it is quite clearly not limited to just the relationship between the insured and the insurer.
Well, it's our understanding, Your Honor, that the business of insurance is a specialized industry to which the McCarran-Ferguson Act was pertaining to. What insurance companies do when they're selling, negotiating, selling, and purchasing, people purchase insurance, and the types of deceptive trade practices and misrepresentations that insurance companies can make to policyholders when they are negotiating and selling these policies. And so we're talking about that trade practice versus the broader spectrum of the insurance company dealing with its employees or vendors and those kinds of things, which are really not in the trade of insurance.
Well, it certainly is that aspect of the Act, the Deceptive Practice Act aspect, misrepresentation of policyholders that have generated most of the litigation in the past. But if you read the Act itself, it is, as you just said, regulation of trade practices, and it goes far beyond just the relationship between the policyholder and the insurance company, doesn't it?
There have been some cases, Your Honor, in the Supreme Court that we cited in our brief that have dealt with other types of practices, for example, discounts to drug companies for policyholders. The Supreme Court has found that not to be in the business of insurance, and there are other aspects of what insurance companies do as a part of selling insurance that the Supreme Court has specifically found not to be in the business of insurance. Now, I might point out to the court that in the There's a case that we did find. It's the Arizona versus Norris case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision that addresses this issue in a footnote, footnote 17, where the court had before it what appeared to be an employment dispute. And I will quote footnote 17 that dealt with the McCarran-Ferguson Act and its applicability to the employer-employee relationship. The court said, "All that is at issue in this case is an employment practice, the practice of offering a male employee the opportunity to obtain greater monthly annuity benefits than could be obtained similarly situated female employees. It is this conduct by the employer that is prohibited by Title VII in this case." Then the court goes on to say, "By its own terms, the McCarran-Ferguson Act applies only to the business of insurance and has no application to employment practices." This was in a footnote, and I think it's a pronouncement that the Supreme Court of the United States takes the position that when you deal with the employer-employee relationship, which is in the insurance industry, it's no different than that same relationship with any other industry, and therefore we're not going to carve out a special exception for those kinds of disputes and provide trouble damages to employees who are discharged or not hired or not promoted or whatever the case may be. There are laws, employment laws, already on the books in state courts in the state of Texas. There are federal statutes which protect employees who have those kind of disputes, and we're not going to allow the employee to then be able to collect trouble damages for something just because that person is employed with an insurance company.
I'd like to comment about McCarran-Ferguson, which is certainly worth considering, but it is not a comment on how Texas implemented its rights under McCarran-Ferguson. There's not any definition in Article 2121 of the business of insurance or of what trade practices means.
There is no specific definition in the Article 2121 that specifically addresses that. Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with you. However, there have been pronouncements by this court where the court has had an opportunity to address how far can companies go, how far can courts go in including typical employment disputes or other types of disputes that are not typically the trade practice of insurance. And the first case that comes to mind is the Aetna versus Marshall case, in which Judge Gonzalez vigorously dissented about what the applicability of Article 2121 really means. And even though in that case it involved the enforcement of a settlement agreement of a workers' compensation case, I think there's language in especially Judge Gonzalez's dissent that the overtone is that if you have something over and above what is a trade or the business of insurance or a trade practice of the business of insurance, then you have other remedies. But if you have something dealing with policyholders or negotiating or purchasing or selling insurance, which is something specific to the insurance industry, then Article 2121 is applicable. There are other cases that we believe are also illustrative of my point. The Texas Health versus Gentry case, Allied General versus Moody case. I think also the Chaffin versus Transamerica case, which defines what a person is. And in that case, which was decided by the 14th District Court of Appeals in Houston, the court held that this was a person was defined as one who is authorized to bring an action against a company in the business of insurance is limited to one who is either an insured or a beneficiary of an insurance policy. And I think that pronouncement makes it clear that the courts see this as something that is specialized to insurance companies and should not be something that will be utilized broadly by employees of insurance companies to gain more than what is now reserved to employees of other industries who do have employment disputes with their employer. The group life insurance case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, is very illustrative of what elements have to be shown before, in fact, Article 2121 is applicable. The first is, does the practice transfer or spread policyholders' risk? It is our position that the employment of Mr. Moss in this case, by Century has no effect of spreading risk on the policyholders. The second element that the court said in Group Life that must be examined is the practice an integral part of the policy relationship between the insurer and the insured? It is our position that Moss's employment was not an integral part of Century's relationship with its policyholders. And the third element that the U.S. Supreme Court addressed in Group Life was, is the practice limited to entities within the insurance industry? And we believe that Century's employment of agents that's something that is not peculiar to the insurance industry. It's like employing a salesman in any other type of industry to do business for that particular company. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, did we present arguments from respondents?
May it please the court. Your honors, my name is Denise Hubbard, and I'm representing the respondent in this case. In listening to petitioner's argument, I did not hear him give the court one reason why it should reverse this judgment. This judgment was recovered by Mr. Moss based on four other theories besides the Texas Insurance Code, namely negligence, negligent misrepresentation, gross negligence, and fraud. None of those theories of recovery are being attacked in this court. All of those theories give the plaintiff an independent basis to recover his actual damages as well as prejudgment interest and the fraud element, which the court awarded $75,000 in punitive damages for, gives the plaintiff an independent recovery for attorney's fees.
Is that included in the $75,000?
No, Your Honor. The court made a separate award of attorney's fees.
How are attorney's fees awardable on a fraud case?
Your Honor, if it pleases the court, I did file a supplemental brief based on that very issue. And in there are at least two cases that I cited, I'm sorry, three cases, Plantit Plows versus Evans, a 1980 case, Keller versus Davis, a 1985 Houston case, and Moore versus Rotello, another 1986 Houston case, in which each of the courts say that attorney's fees may be awarded as a separate element of punitive damages. And the Moore case specifically addresses the question of whether the court may award attorney's fees as a separate element in addition to the punitive damages.
Didn't
and the court said that it could.
Did the trial court do that?
Yes,
sir.
Did the
trial court say, as a separate element of punitive damages, I award attorney's fees also?
Your Honor, I'll read you the finding of fact. It says it's number 53, that the plaintiff is entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees in the amount of $190,402.12 under the insurance code and or as additional damages for fraud.
And in any event, there's no challenge in this court to awarding attorney's fees because of the fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Or any claim that attorney's fees couldn't be part of your exemplary damages recovery, the kind of matter covered in Keller against Davis.
That's correct.
The only complaint is that one of two grounds relied upon by the trial court for awarding attorney's fees, that being Article 2121, is not a legitimate basis for awarding those fees.
That's correct.
And then a no evidence point, I think, as well on the fraud.
But there is no evidence point on the fraud, Your Honor.
So that's the only thing?
Yes, sir. And so it's our contention before the court that whatever opinion this court renders today will not require a reversal of this judgment, that there's nothing to reverse the judgment on because we have four independent bases, as I've said, for recovery. And as you pointed out, we have an additional element to recover attorney's fees under. As to the issue of the employment contract dispute, there was no employment relationship here. The court made a finding in finding number 56 that Moss was never hired by Century and never became an employee of Century. So I take dispute with Mr. Wickliffe that it is an employer dispute. But I, quite frankly, do not have any cases which would indicate that this particular type of transaction or action is covered under the insurance code. I think this is a case of first impression in that regard. As Justice Doggett pointed out, the Texas Insurance Code does not require that a person suing under the code be a consumer. In this case, Golden Moss was an independent insurance agent. Both of the parties were obviously involved, engaged in the business of insurance. But I admit to the court that it's up to the court as to whether or not it wants to extend the language of the statute to include this type of situation and disapprove Judge Burgess's language in his opinion.
Do you get 40% that was awarded, or do you get 40%, that 40% plus another 40%?
Your Honor, as far as the attorney's fees, we would get the exact amount that was awarded, which was $190,402.12, which would be 40%.
I didn't know how the fee contract read.
You mean an additional 40% in addition to what?
The attorney's fees.
No, the contract read 40% of the recovery. So, Your Honors, I submit to the court that this is a very, quite frankly, a simple case that is not a difficult question in terms of whether or not the judgment should be reversed. He hasn't given you a reason, and I ask you to uphold the judgment, and regardless of whether you decide to make this type of action recoverable under the Texas Insurance Code. If there are no questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Well, I hate to ask questions about the curious posture of this case, but I feel compelled to do so. The attorney's fees have been paid.
No, Your Honor, they have not.
Well, you have a partial release. You alleged in a pleading you filed before our court that the case was moot, and then you filed a document, a partial settlement, and you make an allegation that you have a partial release of judgment. And did you file a pleading that states that this issue was moot?
We filed a supplemental brief, yes, sir.
And would you say that any decision that this court would render on any point would be moot, other than the attorney's fees would be moot? I say the judgment has been paid, but not the attorney's fees. Is that it?
That's correct.
I see. I have no questions.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Justice Gonzalez, one of the points that we have is that partial release of judgment is extremely important. It's important because there was an error committed by the clerk's office advising the parties about what point of error was being considered by the court. And to satisfy the judgment except for attorney's fees, the rest of the judgment was paid.
Well, you understand that when we list a point of error, that doesn't limit our consideration to just that point of error.
Well,
I do now.
I do now. In that partial release of judgment, the language is specific on the issue of attorney's fees and says that issue will not be, those monies will not be paid until the other issues in the case are decided. Now, as far as we're concerned, they have waived any right to say that the issue is moot because they have specifically said that the issue of attorney's fees will be resolved after the court decides this case. And finding of fact number 53 that my opposing counsel just mentioned to you, if it's read very carefully, it says $190,000 for attorney's fees under the insurance code and or as additional damages under fraud. It's not saying attorney's fees for fraud, as they try to liberally read it, to bootstrap an argument that they're entitled to attorney's fees.
What do you do
fees
with that language, counsel, and are additional damages for fraud? You just disregard that language?
Well, if it had not been for the partial release of judgment and had been signed by the opposing side, it may have some relevance, Your Honor, at this point in time. But the trial court placed it in the alternative. If you can't get insurance fees under the insurance code, then we're going to give you the $190,000 as additional damages for fraud.
It's part of your exemplaries, right?
Yes. Right. But in the cases that have been cited, I say yes. I read that to mean actual damages for fraud, not exemplary damages, because there was a specific finding.
Additional damages for fraud.
Yes, Your Honor.
Additional, usually in addition to actual.
All right. And, Your Honor, our point is that the cases that they have cited, we received their supplemental brief on yesterday, and I've not had an opportunity, obviously, to file a response, and I will do so. But those cases deal with excessive exemplary damages and whether or not there should be any remittiture and whether attorney's fees ought to be included in those exemplary damages. In those cases, there was no statutory cause of action permitting attorney's fees. And so what those cases have allowed is attorney's fees for fraud, or not fraud, but negligence, where punitive damages have been awarded as a way of getting the attorney's fees. In our case, we had specific findings on attorney's fees, actual damages, and exemplary damages. And we think it would be stretching the cases cited by the opposing side to say that they can now collect an additional amount of attorney's fees for exemplary damages when there have been specific findings on those by the trial court. Otherwise, what we'll be doing is allowing a double recovery of attorney's fees would be our position, Your Honor. If there are no other questions, I will close.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take another brief recess.